chastity shawl. For my sister's 21st birthday, my mom and I decided to plan a legendary getaway. We would take my sister to Las Vegas to celebrate her legal drinking age and see family favorite pop artist Lady Gaga during her residency. Who wouldn't want to pound drinks, visit one of the best modern pop artists, and travel for their big 21st? To make it more exciting, we were taking my sister's gay best friend Declan, and my best friend Monica was meeting us out there. My father jumped in on the trip as well. June in Vegas was going to be hot, but so were we when we hit the strip. My mother had helped plan the trip, but had decided to stay behind and babysit for my sister's two young girls. Someone responsible had to lead the charge. My mother was the only option. My sister's fiancé worked a lot, and my father would be flying in that Sunday, and even if my dad wasn't flying in, I doubt he could fully hold down a responsible title. My dad wanted to travel to a national park, so my mother decided to reserve a rental car for us. At this point in my life, I hadn't had that much experience with rental cars, mainly because I was 24 at the time of the story. I thought it was a great idea because who doesn't love national parks? We got plane tickets on Spirit, which didn't cancel or push the flight back. It was a rare form for the cheap airline. For the first time flying on Spirit, I felt confident. Not because of Spirit, but because of the spirit of adventure that lay before us. I was correct that there would be a spirit of adventure, but the picture I had on my flight to Vegas differed from the soon-to-be reality. It would be like one of those paintings made out of dots. When making the painting, you'd think it was the best piece ever, and when the hard labor's complete, you see it looks like slop. The Las Vegas airport is actually better than the average airport because it's clean and has bright, shiny neon slot machines. I'm not a gambler. I'm merely attracted to shiny things like a bat, a moth, or someone who's taken too many party drugs. We exited the airport to arrive to a place where you pick up rental cars. I didn't have experience, but my Hollywood movie background told me that you usually just went to a desk in the airport to rent a car. We had to take a shuttle, which would take us to a nearby building that housed the various car rentals. "A shuttle doesn't seem too bad," I said, a bit thrown, but it seemed easy enough. We'd hop on over next door, grab a car, and soon find ourselves driving down the strip, hair tossed in abandon. However, when the shuttle arrived at the car rental stop, I discovered that we had to take a second shuttle to our car rental place. I felt like I was in the lowest class in the Titanic. While others who went with big rental car companies were rolling to the reservation desk of their choice, we waited 15 minutes before a more minor, cramped shuttle arrived. This shuttle wasn't as efficient or classy as our first one. The second shuttle was the offspring of a bus and a square car. Annalise, Declan, and I would be boarding along with a couple others, all with luggage. Talk about a clown car of people and suitcases. "Oh my gosh," I told Annalise and Declan. "The car rental place we're going to must be so cheap that it's even further away from the airport." Annalise did prefer the finer things, but adapted well. But you could tell Declan was a fancy salmon that did not want to schlep in this country bumpkin river. I checked the name of the car rental company, Economy. I had never heard of this brand in my life. The company name did imply cheap, so maybe I should have spent extra money on the name brand. I was curious. Are we being shuttled to our deaths? Is this what happens when you're too cheap? You fall victim to a rental car scam? Imagine this second shuttle taking us to a death house of horrors. Of course, none of this happened. I can't even blame my obsession over true crime podcasts because that would blossom the following year. Soon enough, there would be a financial murder, but no physical harm would happen. To make the situation even weirder, the bus driver decided to masquerade as a tour guide. While I appreciated his attempt to entertain, he pointed out the worst things one could mention on an impromptu tour. I think it was his way of elevating the experience or apologizing for the state of the shuttle. "This CVS right here to our right is actually open 24/7. He mentioned that as if I planned to revisit the Outer Banks of Vegas just for a CVS. The car rental place was in the middle of an oversized lot in the middle of the desert. Imagine a giant mall-type lot filled with gravel and used cars. "Where are we?" I asked as we stepped out of the shuttle. The place looked deserted. It was now around 9 p.m. on a Friday, and I had assumed I would have had the car by now. However, this car rental place was more packed than an authentic burrito at a Mexican restaurant. We were behind at least five or six groups of people looking to get a car. Annalise, Declan, and I joined the queue, and I could feel my energy slowly draining out of me. The older couple in front of me began to mutter, "Do you see how the employees at the counter keep chatting with people?" Usually I would find fault with older adults regarding their opinion of retail and customer service workers, but I tuned in like a radio signal to the nearest reception counter to hear the car rental employee say, "Where are you staying for your trip?" The employee behind the counter asked the couple he was currently helping. The couple genuinely answered with a couple of minutes of banter. I was aghast. This line was out of control, and the employees and customers were wasting time talking about the Hilton Hotel's benefit packages. This was not the time for a trip to Small Talk City. This was a time for a speedy journey on Let's Hurry It Uptown. It's one thing if the small talk is happening during the transaction, such as when the Trader Joe's employee asks if you had the new mango guacamole while they ring out the 50 pre-made meals I've added to my cart. While I waited for the customers to finish giving their life stories, I was mentally preparing to quickly get through the eventual conversation with my future reception employee, knee discussion partner. My mother had booked the car for the trip and had told me she had gotten it for $100. All I had to do was show up and pay for the vehicle. Easy. And at this point, the hassle for a $100 total car rental seemed worth it, even with Annalise and Declan mewing like cats. Except at least cats don't keep saying, "Oh, this is so slow. I just want to get to the hotel room." Finally, we approached the counter, and the employee explained that I had to put down a $200 deposit. No stress. And then he calculated the remaining fees, which came to a total of $628. I felt my body buckle under the pressure as if the jury had found me guilty of murder. I should have known that a $100 car rental for 4 days was impossible, but a more conservative estimate of $400 or $500 was instantly shattered by this economic price point. Technically, I was going to get $200 back, or was I? But I still can't believe I was about to put this much on my card. Reasonable people might ask, why did you spend the money on the car? Why didn't you walk away and order an Uber? The thought didn't cross my mind at all. Annalise and Declan were now muttering how they were hungry and thirsty and wanted to change and hit the strip. They were like two adult children. I was the sober chaperone ready to abandon them at a fire station. We were in the middle of nowhere Nevada, potentially even across the state border. Best friend Monica had flown in earlier and had asked for travel reports. Monica was worried because it was getting close to club time at Caesar's Palace, and if we got there too late, we might not make it in. I could feel the stress building up, and I was willing to do whatever I needed to do to get out of that car rental place in the middle of nowhere. I begrudgingly handed my credit card over, like submitting money for a wasp's young child. Moments later, we were in the car and on the way to the hotel. Driving that decently nice car down the strip was worth some of the money I spent. And trust me, I made sure we got our money's worth. We did a drive through the desert that weekend that was gorgeous, soaking up the desert as if making an artistic interpretation of a horse with no name. We also drove up to the classic Las Vegas sign that everyone knew. My dad and I would even take the car to Utah, but I still didn't know if the rental car was worth the financial compensation. My wallet vehemently disagrees. My mother also handled the hotel booking. It's not that I was incapable of handling the hotel booking. We had planned that my mother would come, and we would split some of the pre-vacation work duties. My mother booked the hotel and found the $100 total car rental that was actually $628. I got the Lady Gaga tickets. There was a clear distinction between our skills and abilities. "The hotel is Travelodge," my mother had informed me before I had left. "It's close to the airport." The proximity of the closeness to the airport didn't bother me, considering we had an expensive rental car that was going to shuttle us around. The hotel could have been 40 miles from the airport, which would have been okay because we had a shiny rental car. Any decently knowledgeable Vegas tourist knows precisely where the Travelodge is. It's in the middle of the strip and was the only simple hotel around for blocks. The vast majority of the Las Vegas Strip hotels were the physical embodiment of the phrase, "The party's here, boys." The Travelodge on the Strip stood stoic and plain around the peacocking hotels. This hotel was like a nerdy girl in an 80s movie who takes off her glasses to reveal a subtle cuteness. To me, this was the perfect win. We'd be in the heat of the action without paying for access that my poor middle-class bank account could not afford. We arrived at the Travelodge in our rental car, and I recalled the information that the hotel had free parking, which felt like my first win since landing in Vegas. We took our bags and belongings to the front desk reception to check in. The hotel and our group quickly discovered that we did not have a reservation at the hotel. "What do you mean?" I said in a half-Karen approach. "Isn't this the Travelodge?"
"Can I see your reservation email confirmation?"
the receptionist coolly asked. I handed over my phone with a tinge of satisfaction. He will see the email and apologize by blaming the system. To apologize, we might be upgraded to the presidential suite equivalent that the Travelodge offers. Maybe the mayoral chambers, the comptroller's lounge.
"Oh, I see the problem," the receptionist said with a nod. "This happens on occasion. We're the Travelodge on the Strip. You reserved a room at the Travelodge by the airport."
My bruised pride and ego accepted the mistake graciously and thanked the man. We piled back into the rental car and headed to our actual hotel. As we left the Strip, we could see all the fun amenities twinkling goodbye as if saying, "You could have had this." The Travelodge on the Strip was in the middle of the Vegas Strip, and the Travelodge by the airport was out in the boonies of Las Vegas, right next to the airport. You could walk to the protective airport fencing in 2 minutes from our room. The hotel probably qualified as one of those hotels the airlines would put up people in if their flights were postponed for a day. The hotel wasn't just off the Strip. It was off the Strip and then 10 blocks over. Even for a minimal hotel, the Travelodge by the airport was depressing. The parking lot was covered with broken rundown cars next to an abandoned swimming pool closed for construction that I feared wasn't coming. People hung out outside their rooms as if searching for prey. It wouldn't surprise me if this was a place that dealt with drug distribution or illegal sex work. Arriving back at this hotel to find a murder scene would have felt on brand for the hotel as well. Our room was also sad. It was the hotel a recently divorced man might stay in after his wife says to get out of the house. I would have been worried had the hotel room come with a minibar. Declan and Annalise were the people who would accidentally crack open a $10 bottle of water or go on a candy binge and fail to realize the stack of charges coming our way. I liked cheap stays, but even I would have shelled out economy car rental cash to stay in a slightly better situation. For 4 nights, I was paying over $400 for this dump, and we didn't even have a pool in summer in Vegas. In this moment of realization, I felt like I was in an early 2000s comedy movie. All these friends gather for a fun Vegas weekend, only to discover the illusions they believed in had fallen to waste. This setup was rife with natural comedy and growing conflict. Monica was still continuously texting me because we had to hurry to see Zed at the Coliseum. Monica had booked a cheaper hotel, which was actually on the Strip. Her hotel was a 15-minute walk from our hotel, which meant we were 15 minutes off the Strip. I was jealous that Monica was on the Strip, but mainly that she paid less for her stay. After looping to grab Monica, we arrived at the Coliseum moments later, looking pretty decent for people who had completed a plane trip, an extensive car rental hassle, and a hotel switch-up. It was a summer Friday night in Vegas, so the place was slammed. People were here to party, drink, gamble, and celebrate a few vices. It didn't matter if the DJ was Zed or your cousin who gets the aux cord and ruins the mood with his music choices.
"Let's get in line," Monica pointed to the line of people waiting for Zed.
We discovered that while Monica and Annalise would get into the club for free, Declan and I would have to pay $100 to get in. On my previous trips to Las Vegas, I had only hit a little of the nightlife. I would go out late at night and bar hop, but I wasn't trying to be part of this young, hip, boozy culture of Las Vegas. In a world that continuously bolstered men and demeaned women, I liked the idea of a reverse patriarchal system where women were free, but men had to pay. Even if the justification was that women were sexy and could lure men in for money, it still felt like the patriarchy was benefiting somehow in this whole system. If you are a man who wants to know what it's like being a woman, visit the Las Vegas nightclub. It's just super hashtag fun. You'll be disrespected, ripped off, and abused. But don't worry. I'm way too frugal to pay $100 to get into a club to dance. If I had been drunk, I would have paid that much, or had casual amnesia about the fact that I had paid that much. I would have paid if I had only spent $100 at the car rental place. Declan also bowed out, so we decided to gamble and walk around for the evening. Eventually, my sister decided it was late and left the Zed concert. Monica would go on to work her way to a great seat in the show. Her words and beauty, a persuasion that no VIP ticket holder could refuse. That was a whimsical night. Annalise, Declan, and I cruised the strip at midnight, taking many photos like Kardashians and creating content. Part of the reason I love visiting Las Vegas isn't for the clubs, or the strip clubs, or the clubs that are half club and part pool. I attend Vegas specifically for the club sandwiches and various crudités of a Las Vegas buffet. This story was pre-pandemic. While a pandemic made me swear up buffets for a long time, I will forever buckle under the beauty of a Vegas buffet. They're full of lush desserts, brimming salad bars, meats of all designs, seafood delights, none for me, and international cuisine that tastes pretty good for what I'm assuming is not an international kitchen. It is the best hour and a half you can spend in the City of Sin. You could pay $20 for a burger in Vegas, but why not pay $40 or $50 for a fountain of food? I'm a systematic buffet eater. I always go for expensive foods, foods you can't get at home, and meats. I love a good salad, but never waste my time with dollar bag lettuce at the Vegas buffet. You have to take advantage of this system by getting steaks, sous vide, and eggs benedict for breakfast. And sometimes you smuggle an apple for a snack later in the day if you don't appear too conspicuous. Saturday morning, we decided that the first buffet on our to-try list was the Wynn. The Wynn is classy and decorated with flower arrangements and a significant waterfall feature. There was no comparison to venues like Hooters that hosted Dollar Blackjack. We weren't staying at the Wynn because we were fresh out of sugar daddies who could afford the room price. But you didn't have to stay at the Wynn to eat at the buffet. We were hungry due to the booze, and it had been roughly 10 or 12 hours since last night's Taco Bell Cantina stop. The line was long, as if we were waiting to ride a roller coaster at Cedar Point. The main difference was that we weren't waiting for a 2-minute adrenaline rush on a steel monster. We were preparing to open our jaws wide, like miniature steel jaws of life, to eat. The goal was always to eat more than the price of admission. It's almost an ancient art form to internally calculate a rough idea of what you ate versus how the food you ate at the buffet could be charged a la carte. We paid for our buffet table and waited too long to sit. Something was wrong, but I wasn't sure what it was. It's probably the feeling soldiers have in movies when they think there's a bomb and it turns out to be a bomb and said bomb explodes. The tragedy is that had the soldier followed his gut, the bomb wouldn't have killed members of his squad. A woman who reeked of managerial talent approached us. She was holding a shawl in her left hand, and her knuckles were gripped more than my anticipation to wreck this buffet. The shawl within her grip resembled something an old lady might wear to church, or a shawl you would confuse for a fancy napkin at a French restaurant. It was a wretched mustard yellow color, like grade school puke or cheddar cheese past its prime. The shawl desired to be gold, but fell into the murky mustard yellow that would never be welcomed on any hot dog. One glance at the shawl told me that whoever previously owned this ancient artifact was not disappointed in leaving it behind. This was a piece of clothing you could easily abandon in your travels, or best lost in the far reaches of your closet. You would be disappointed to find out that you had even owned this shawl. You'd look at the shawl and wonder, how did I get here? Why would I purchase this in the first place? Had I ever worn that shawl? It may be true what the locals in the town village say. I have no fashion sense. And how had the supervisor come into possession of the shawl? Was it her personal shawl? If this was the case, I needed the fashion police to arrest this woman on the spot. No arrest warrant required. And where had this shawl been? Was it used to wipe spills at tables? A fancy rag the cleaning staff utilized when customers weren't around? Had the shawl been a lost item, and the manager held it on behalf of lost and found? Maybe the manager was trying to run after someone who had left their vintage shawl behind the table? "Ma'am, ma'am," the manager cried out with a croaky, broken voice of desperation to find the shawl's original owner. "You almost left without taking this ugly piece of fabric with you. Don't worry. Here at the Wynn Buffet, we will always ensure you don't leave anything behind." But instead of any of those scenarios that had quickly whipped into my creative yet arguably neurotic brain, something unexpected happened entirely.
The manager aimed her sights at us, locking on us like a cartoon villain, ready to unleash their plan. We were like the enemy submarine, and she was the missile launching. The manager held the shawl like a young man might pick up a sock that he had disgustingly utilized for dirty shenanigans. Finally, she spoke, addressing Monica individually. "Miss, I'm going to have to ask you to wear this." The manager's tone and eye glance were both judgmental in nature, as if we were kissing cousins or demanding to bring cannibalism back in vogue. It was a judgment that both disapproved of our existence and suggested we were utterly ignorant of her and society's perspective. I could see her clocking out of her shift, driving home to her lovely condo, and venting to her partner, sibling, roommate, neighbor, or cat. "You wouldn't believe what happened at the Wynn Hotel today." Monica accepted the shawl, holding it like it had anthrax. I can't believe Monica grabbed onto the shawl in the first place. The shawl carried foreboding energy that made me instinctively back away. Looking into it was like staring into a hole that led to hell. "Where am I supposed to wear this?" Monica guffawed, looking between me, Annalise, Declan, and the supervisor. Annalise, Declan, and I had no answers to give Monica. I felt like I was on a game show, and it was my turn to provide a solution. I genuinely was speechless and doing a poor imitation of the shrug emoji. Monica had a bare midriff, an open stomach and backside, and booty shorts. There were multiple skin locations, all of which qualified for the supervisor's shawl. If there was an issue with Monica's bare skin, many places could be the problematic region, and for the record, Monica looked fantastic. The supervisor sighed, as if the answer to Monica's question was evident, and we were too stupid to piece together the logic. We were tempting her customer service skills to break out into hellfire. The supervisor did a small closed roll of the eyes on the verge of opening their lids for the entire roll effect. The supervisor pointed her finger at Monica as if pointing to the town witch and signaling everyone to grab their fire, rocks, and rope. "We have a dress policy, and those shorts are too short for our policy." The supervisor demanded that Monica wrap this crusty shawl around her waist to hide her tanned upper thighs from the room. I looked around the room to see what the enforced dress policy was. A lot of brunch guests were wearing sweatpants. Some of those sweatpants had text scribbled across the cheeks in various proclamations like "Wildcats" and "Juicy." Some proudly wore tattered rags, while the average buffet attendee had donned short pieces of clothing with something on display. It was well over 100 degrees, and most people had dressed accordingly. Monica and Annalise had forgotten to bring their robes to keep men's wandering eyes in check. I doubted anyone was worried about seeing Monica's upper thighs at the buffet. Most men were so full from the limitless buffet situation to become fully aroused. Our arrival was an emergency for the Wynn Hotel buffet staff. Walkie-talkies crackled with code red, and proper dress code situation. Men dotted SWAT gear designed to stop sexy women from arousing them. Mr. Wynn himself would be abreast of the situation, revolving around Monica's almost visible lower butt cheek. Whoever had allowed us to pay already for the buffet would be fired for gross incompetence. "What happened to Shirley?" a staff member would ask. "Shirley let some harlot wear shorts and almost allowed some trash through," a different staff member would explain. "We can't have someone at the Wynn allowing a clothes-denying tart through the buffet line." The mustard shawl had been locked behind glass like a fire extinguisher, imprisoned like Han Solo in Star Wars, or maybe the shawl was stuck at the bottom of the lost and found pile. Employees scrounged around to find something respectable for Monica to wear. Possibly they had borrowed the shawl from a visitor or employee. "Ma'am, you're well-dressed today like a proper woman," the supervisor had said to someone. "May we use your shawl to turn this scarlet-lettered slut into a mustard-shawled woman?" Did the Wynn themselves sell the shawl? Maybe it was from the 1980s and nobody had purchased it, so it was in the back storage room of the gift shop, with the audacity to be on sale for an exuberant $40. But that situation felt too fancy for a musty-looking shawl. Instead, I bet the supervisor ran to the kitchen, sweat pouring down her neck. "Kitchen staff," she cried out, trying to remain calm about the DEFCON 5 situation brewing at the pay desk in front of the buffet. "We have a woman who's decided to dress like any woman you would see on the Vegas Strip. Does anyone have anything we can wrap her in to hide her from God's heavenly light? But maybe I was overthinking this whole situation. What if the shawl had come out of the supervisor's mammoth-sized knockoff brand-name purse? The supervisor used her manicured nails to dig deep, bypassing a Luna bar, some crumpled receipts, some compact that she didn't bother putting on in the first place, and there, shining with a halo, was the shawl. It sat at the bottom of the purse like a murky, mysterious underground lake. And with the shawl in tow, the supervisor confronted the whore who decided to wear booty shorts to a Las Vegas buffet. At this point, Monica still held onto the natty shawl with as few fingers as possible. Monica pushed her hand forward, offering the shawl back to the manager. "I'm not wearing this," Monica muttered with an outstanding balance of reason and sass. The supervisor looked offended, as if Monica had tossed the rag in her face. Before the supervisor could take a deep breath and blast Monica to the next dimension, Monica came up with a shawl-free option. "What if I just pull my shorts down a bit?" Monica probably had a good inch of fabric that could hide some of her upper thighs without exposing her other sensitive region. The supervisor grabbed the shawl and held it as if she was Mary Magdalene clutching the cloth used to wipe Jesus' face. Monica rearranged her shorts, which didn't evoke that much of a difference. The supervisor cocked her head 20 degrees to the right, as if she was a curious bird, or if she needed to crack her neck. Was the head cocking supposed to help her in any way?
"Well, are the shorts going to stay that way?"
the supervisor asked, implying that Monica was lying merely to eat roast sirloin. Once free of the clutches of the modesty police, Monica would slide her pants up to showcase her assets.
"Yes?"
Monica said, a bit thrown off, but willing to do anything for food. I was stifling a laugh and nodding, as if I was personally going to watch Monica's shorts for the possible shenanigans. I was the night's watch, but for shorts. The supervisor balled up the shawl and then allowed us to be seated. We were then led through the wind buffet, filled with people who had barely met the dress code themselves, people who had their own battles against modesty. Thin spaghetti straps, bras hanging a bit loose and wild, shorts that were just an inch lower than Monica's own, sandals that displayed an assortment of feet. Everywhere you looked seemed to host a violator on the cusp of their own chastity shawl. I felt like one of those creepy older men who stare down at a beautiful woman, with or without provocative clothing, but I noticed more violations that had gone unnoticed. I felt the supervisor's eyes for our entire buffet stay. The supervisor must have been worried that her classy wind buffet establishment would fall apart due to one beautiful woman's derriere. I imagined her gritting and grinding her teeth as if she was sanding down corn in a mortar bowl with a pestle. The disapproving stare from the supervisor wasn't the first of its kind, but her attitude that we would ruin everything known to man was humorous. All around us, people shoveled buckets of food into their mouths, most likely unoffended by the flesh. Unlike the supervisor, the fellow buffet attendees were aware that worse sins happen in Las Vegas. Monica spent her Saturday at the pool while Declan, Annalise, and I explored and eventually saw Lady Gaga. There is beautiful magic to a Las Vegas residency, especially with a famous artist in a cozy small theater. We ended the night earlier since Annalise and Declan had an early flight. My dad, the King of Vegas, would fly in tomorrow morning. Monica was staying through till Tuesday along with my dad and I. My father and I had planned to spend Sunday going to Zion National Park. "I specifically want to go to this place called Angel's Landing," my father told me leading up to the trip. "I heard it's nice." I didn't have any knowledge of the park or its specifics, but I loved nature. Even though I wouldn't declare myself a hiker, I enjoyed walking amongst nature. Usually the hikes I love are flat and filled with gorgeous scenery. For some reason, we only brought a couple bottles of water, no snacks, and no proper gear. I was dressed as more of a tourist wearing activewear than someone trying to accomplish a hike. We arrived at Zion around 11 or noon to find a bustling park. When we arrived, the sun was beginning its afternoon peak. The sun was beating down on people like a landlord looking for rent money. Hikers would tell you that starting your hike this late in the day is a bad idea. The idea is that you're finishing the challenging parts of your trek by the time the sun gets decently high in the sky. The sun and I don't have that great of a relationship either.
I'm quick to burn, thanks to my Irish ancestral blood, which probably comes from a history of cave-dwelling humans and naturally gray and cloudy skies. In the past, I've blistered, burned, seared, and cooked my way through hazardous and painful situations that make me cautious. Zion itself is free, but the parking is not. It feels a bit of a tease, like a free appetizer, but the entree is double the price to offset the cost of the free appetizer. After paying way too much to park, we climbed into the shuttle ride to go deep into the Zion wilderness. The shuttle ride was non-eventful, but I was constantly perking up due to the overhead voiceovers. A series of messages came on over the muffled low-def shuttle speakers featuring everyone who worked at the Zion National Park. "Hi, it's Mark from the recycling plant at the canyon. Just a reminder not to throw bottles in the park."
"Hi, it's Janine from Animal Rescue. Please don't feed the animals in the park. They survive on their natural diet."
Some of the voice messages felt like a bit of a stretch.
"Hi, this is Julie from Concessions. The perfect meal to eat here is our new seasonal pumpkin bread."
The reminder about park recycling felt valid. The message about seasonal slices of bread felt gratuitous. The first stop was where we got on, at the visitor center. Here you could spend tens of dollars on Zion-related merchandise and various hiking and camping gear. The second stop was for a museum. Not a single soul exited to visit the little building.
"We're here at the museum,"
the pre-made voice message exclaimed, but no one matched the excitement in our shuttle. I felt badly because while I did love a good museum, I didn't come to Zion for a museum. It was like going to a wine night and someone suggesting a whole bottle of beer. Not the mood or on the agenda. The third stop was a 2-minute walk from the museum, which didn't warrant a separate stop. The third stop didn't need to exist at all. Why stop twice in the same tenth of a mile? The fourth stop was a rest center, but if the museum and visitor center acted as resting areas, why would a rest center also be needed? Don't the places that have benches and water count as rest centers? Finally, the shuttle lurched forward into the actual park.
"It's Lindsay from marketing. Here at the park..."
The bus could explode into giant cartoony flames, but the voiceover and speaker system would survive the wreckage. While human bodies fell in scarlet flames, the speaker system continued to droll on and on about the park. Stop 7 is finally around the corner, and voiceover explains that to the left is a beautiful river walk with a waterfall.
"And to the right is Angel's Landing, which is a more strenuous hike," the lady said in a relaxing tone.
When I hear the word strenuous, I think hard, but accomplishable. For instance, trying to do a Costco run and pay less than $100 was strenuous. An hour on the elliptical was harrowing. Both these examples allow you to fail, but it would be okay. Spending $150 at Costco or exercising for 30 minutes on an elliptical would be fine. But the description of the hike as strenuous felt wrong. The hike deserved a more accurate title. Murderous. The road to Angel's Landing tricks you, because the journey starts with a flat route that slowly inclines into the canyon overpass. You realize there's been an incline at some point, but you're powering through it nicely.
"Is this the strenuous trail?"
I wondered, feeling confident in my amateur hiking ability. Then the elevation increases, but it's still decently flat. You've begun to notice the incline difference and are slowing down. The word strenuous might come into play here. The third leg of the hike is the switchbacks. Switchbacks are zigzag paths carved into the canyons. You'd steeply walk 20 feet upwards to your left and then stop at a landing. You turn around, walk 20 feet upwards to your right, and stop at a landing. This would repeat multiple times in a grueling, monotonous way. You're zigging and zagging, swinging up the canyon in a straight upward line. The hike was definitely strenuous at this point. Part of me wondered why my father thought we could accomplish this hike. There was some competition playing out here. Both my father and I didn't want to be viewed as lesser. I purposefully and continuously set my hiking pace, so I was always faster and ahead of my father. My father quite often jokes about things that he has issues over. He would never think of himself as robust, but would constantly point out that I have a voluptuous figure. In my defense, thick is trendy at the moment. For me, this was not a father-son hike. This hike was a significant chance to prove that my young vigor was no match for his older, fragile self. We arrived at what I thought might be the halfway point. We were over an hour in and now incorporating breaks. other hikers around us heading down the mountain were encouraging us, but also gave their estimation on how far we had left in our hike.
Oh, you're halfway there.
You're like one-third through the hike.
I'd say you're two-fifths finished with your ascent.
Time is not art. The variant estimates in the grand scheme of the hike left me more confused. It was like asking for an estimate on how many eggs one needed for a batch of cookies. You might need 3 or 4 eggs for the recipe. One wouldn't say it could be 2, 3, 5, 7, or 10 eggs. You'd look stupid and unknowledgeable. But people confidently provided outlier time estimates to the point where I had to scrap all the data and assume we were far along. We reached this point in the hike where a natural wind tunnel formed, cooling our faces down under the afternoon sun. This stranger explained to my father and I what was to come.
You'll have a flat road for a bit, then switchbacks, and then many switchbacks.
I was grateful for the flat road, and the next switchbacks turned out to be easier than the former ones. Maybe I had grown accustomed to the switchbacks? Had these cursed path patterns turned me into a better hiker? Those superhero movies always feature people whose training kicks their butt, yet makes them the best in their field. Perhaps I was going through my superhero training. Any confidence I had was shattered upon the final series of switchbacks, which proved to be steeper, more in number, and simply crushing. I was constantly stopping to catch my breath. My muscles were on fire. The sun was now at its maximum height and beating on me as if whacking me with its purse I tried to steal. All the agony washed away as soon as we arrived at the top plateau. It was one of those moments where you were thankful to be on this earth and see the creation spread before you. God forbid, but my hike wasn't too bad compared to what could have happened. But even a sprained wrist, a hungry stomach, or a couple of bruises would have easily made up for this view of heaven on earth. From this plateau, you could see a smaller mountain ahead where you'd rappel onto chains to reach the mountain's true summit. We were at the pre-summit, where most people climbed to and returned. The remaining chain rope climb to the top was not recommended for anyone unless they were advanced hikers. Considering my father and I both had the personality and look of the two old men from the Muppets, I instantly ruled that out for us.
"Should we go on?"
my dad said, a small glimmer of excitement in his eyes as he looked at the bare chain rope dangling and dancing in front of us.
"We can't do that! Are you sure?"
My father looked skeptical, as if I doubted our ability to crack a joke or drive a car in a straight line. At that moment, one of us was pretty sure of our limitations. The other was ignorant at worst and naive at best. "It took us 3 or 4 hours to get here," I muttered, swiveling a burnt hand to indicate that we were currently 3 hours deep on one half of our climb. "There's just no way we're gonna make that. We would plummet." While I sometimes bend reality a bit to my visions, my father can have a misguided sense of what is achievable and what isn't. I remember one family trip he convinced me to throw some stock in crypto. It was right when crypto was hitting a solid peak. Thanks to my dad's investment advice, I lost a couple of $100s. I took that advice because he usually knows what he's talking about when it comes to money. Thankfully, I convinced my father that we should return to the Earth's crust and not chain rope our way to the sky. For all I know, my words had no effect on my father, who just noticed exclusively fit people going further up the chains. I'm sure if you talk to my dad now, he'd say, "Well, we could have climbed to the top." Blindside my father with evidence, and he'd say, "We made the right choice to abandon our hike." I can't even say I hiked down to the bottom. It was more of a rolling and falling trip, like a minor snowball bouldering down a blizzard mountain. I don't even remember the car ride back to Vegas. That's how overcome I was by my heat stroke. I remember being slumped in the passenger seat, spread out like a body you might find at the beginning of a true crime show. I flirted with death that day. There are only a couple of times in my life where I briefly believed I would die. Once a friend gave me a weed gummy that was 400 megagrams of THC. That's the equivalent of handing a missile launcher to someone who's never even held or operated a handgun. I found out more about Angel's Landing after we did the hike. People fall off of Angel's Landing all the time. Multiple deaths were attributed to people falling off the chain or sections of the path that were a bit lackluster. My friend Paul told me that he and his wife were training to do Angel's Landing, and even they decided the hike would be too much for them. Knowing my father, I doubt he knew Angel's Landing was chaotic. I bet he saw a beautiful picture and decided he wanted to see it. That night, we celebrated with the best buffet in Vegas, the Caesar's Palace Buffet. Monica joined us, and between my father and Monica, six crabs found themselves defaced and ripped apart and served with butter and sauce. While I sat looking comatose and burnt, Monica was being hit on by two guys as she pounded down crabs.
"I'm with my family," Monica said,
pointing to my father, who was also eating crab legs as if we had been stuck in Zion for the last week. I probably was serving Blair Witch Project with my spaceless eyes that had seen much on our hiking adventure.
"I'm not your dad."
My father misread the situation, like a typical white father in his 40s.
"You're silly," I told my dad, trying to cover his error so these boys didn't try and steal Monica away.
Later that night, Monica and I got into a pool party club situation. Since I was a guy, I was paying $20 a drink. Monica continued using her shawless thighs, bright smile, and fantastic personality to siphon free drinks from men. She even managed to get me a couple, which proves how excellent she is at flirting and what a great friend she is to me. The following morning, we were all heading back home. Monica was the flyer who wanted an accurate time of when she would arrive via plane. She didn't care if she had to spend a couple hundred more if it meant that there would be no delays and a bit more legroom. Meanwhile, my father and I didn't mind a couple of hours lost if it meant that the plane ticket cost under $100. I was desperate to get home so I could adequately rest. My desire was a jinx because Spirit Airlines delayed our flight. I leaned back in one of those uncomfortable airport chairs from the 1960s. A lady with a small child and dog was distraught at the natural phenomenon of lateness. She complained loudly to the front desk agent as if she had never heard of a late flight. I noticed she was dragging her dog on the leash, and upon closer inspection, saw that the dog had three legs. Instead of giving the animal time to walk, she decided to drag the dog behind her. She looked like a toddler who wasn't strong enough to lift an object thoroughly, thus she had no choice but to move their own body and allow things to billow after them.
"That poor dog," I muttered to my dad, who was napping in the airport.
While I needed the proper space, time, mood lighting, background media, and mindset to nap, my father could fall asleep anywhere. He was notorious for napping during his lunch in his workplace's auditorium, sleeping in chairs during the daytime, and even napping while sitting in uncomfortable chairs or on old sofas. It was genuinely admirable that he slept peacefully while jackpot machines blared with alarms and clinking coins in front of people complaining about their flights. Eventually, Spirit Airlines was able to get themselves together, and we boarded the plane. I sat down and pulled out my media devices. While listening to music, I heard a soft commotion and people staring heavily at the front of the plane. I remember seeing a few hostesses gathered, positioned around the lady who had dragged her dog from earlier.
"What's happening?" I asked, curious to what was happening. This was before masks and Karen memes.
"Her son wouldn't stop kicking the seat in front of him, and his mother is defending her son's kicking," the person across the aisle summarized for me.
Sometimes I feel badly for kids who have bad parents, but then I remember bad parents often raise bad children. Even if I paid $100 on a Spirit airplane that showed up 3 hours late and was held together by duct tape, I would expect a kid-kicking free flight. The stewards, who had gathered together to form a Justice League of customer service workers who had enough, were now asking the lady to leave with her dog and child. The plane's attitude was shifting from curious fervor to demanding blood. If this was the Roman Colosseum, the plane's hand would signal a lower to kill position. Finally, with direct threats involving an air marshal or police officer, the woman stood up with her child. At that moment, I began to clap. The entire plane joined in with me, a cacophony that indicated that the aircraft was right to remove this woman, her kid, and her poor dog from the flight. They left to the sound of applause, although I like to think in some weird way, I was applauding the fact that I had made it out of Vegas. I might not have a lot of money and lost some years due to the heat of Zion. Hell, I might always shame myself in the mirror because of that buffet supervisor, but at least I wasn't causing a scene on a plane because I had some dignity and knowledge. Just not enough grace and wisdom to arrive fully clothed at a buffet.